Up next, darker stars. You know, we've talked a lot about Planet X, but darker stars, new evidence, the scope of our growing solar system. Andy Lloyd back with us on Coast to Coast, and we will get right into this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Andy Lloyd back with us after an eight-year hiatus, maybe even a little longer. Andy is a chemistry graduate, university lecturer, author. For more than 20 years, he has researched the subject of Planet X. His very first popular nonfiction title, Dark Star, The Planet X Evidence, explored the science and myth associated with Planet X, relating the Nemesis and Nibiru to the very strange new phenomenon known as brown dwarfs. Now, his work set in motion the very popular concept of the brown dwarf Nibiru across the internet. Andy runs several Planet X-related websites. We've got them linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com and some online forums, and maintains a monthly blog of dark star-related news. His latest work is called Darker Stars, New Evidence, The Scope of Our Growing Solar System, Planet X, Invisible Planetoids, Gas Giants, Comets, Planet Nine, and more. That's quite a title, Andy, and welcome back.
Oh, great to be back on the show, George. Nice to be on Coast to Coast AM.
The search for Planet X continues. Are we any closer?
Yes, we are. 20 years I've been researching this subject. I think it's more exciting, well, certainly in the last two or three years, than it has been for decades. So I wanted to share that all with you and your listeners today. I think the possibility of finding Planet X is getting increasingly great. And it's not just me that's saying that, as somebody who's been into this subject for a long time, researching it for a long time. But actually, there's a strong movement, I guess, or a strong caucus within the astrophysics community that this object is likely out there. Of course, it's got its detractors as well, which I'll talk about. But yeah, this is starting to look pretty good now.
Let's go back some 20 years, Andy. What was it that captured your attention?
So Zechariah Sitchin, I guess, captured my attention. I think anyone who reads any of Zechariah Sitchin's work, it captures their attention.
It does. It does. It captured mine too.
Yeah, and you know, I was really sort of taken with the ingenuity of his work, and you know, the whole conceptual basis. It seemed to bring together so many different strands of thinking. It's very logical. It's very well thought out, well researched, and you know, I really enjoyed reading his books. And because George, I got something of a science background, you know, when I was reading through Sitchin's work, whenever he'd start talking about Nibiru, I would immediately start in my mind thinking, okay, is this possible?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the evidence here? And that part of my brain would start ticking over. And that became quite a big sort of piece of thinking for me. And I read through, I don't know how many books is in the Earth Chronicles, 8 or something. You know, I've worked through the whole genre, really. And read Alan Alford as well, who produced a sort of follow-up book. You know, I started investigating this. And the investigations made me sort of realize that actually, you know, clearly there could be a Planet X, because astronomers have been looking for Planet X for the best part of 150 years. You know, this isn't just relating to a mythological thing.
That's right. Even those doubters are still looking for it, aren't they?
Yes. So it's the concept of another planet in our solar system, however big, it splits the astronomy community. So there are some who are very open to that idea, and some who are, you know, academic, professional astronomers who really sort of get the bug with this. It's kind of a holy grail type thing, and they really want to, you know, who doesn't want to have their name attached to the discovery of a new planet? I mean, it's big, but well, it's just such a big potential discovery for science. So there's a lot of people who get really into it. You know, science is evidence-based. You've got to follow the evidence, but they're sort of taken with that bug, and I guess I've got that bug as well, really, thanks to Zechariah. And then there are, as you say, detractors. There are people who remain very cynical about it. Now, science is about cynicism. It's about looking at the evidence and questioning it and being critical. And you know, if everybody just accepted the possibility that it's there and without the evidence, that wouldn't be right either. So it's very healthy to have that criticism. But over the last 150 years, and I discuss this in Darker Stars, I do a chapter about the history of the whole subject. Over the last 150 years, you know, the fashion, it's come in and out of fashion. So for periods of time, Planet X was really exciting in the astronomy community. Sometimes it would be really exciting in different communities, people who were trying to explain, say, extinctions and so on like that. And then sometimes it's just absolutely a non-subject. No one wants to talk about it. Everyone just says this is dead. You know, anyone who's associated with this is just frankly wearing a tinfoil hat, that kind of thinking. And what's happened in the last few years is it's come right back to the fore within the astrophysics communities. Lots of papers have written on it, and there's a really healthy debate going on, and actually, you know, quite a strong scientific search for this thing.
And I was going to say, this isn't Zachariah Sitchin's theory. He basically has interpreted the Sumerian cuneiform tablets, and he's pointed these things out. So how could he be wrong by some of the skeptics when he's merely reporting on what he has found?
Yes, absolutely right. I think I can't speak for the people who criticize Zachariah Sitchin's work. I mean, I've read his book. It seems to be a tremendous amount of common sense in there. It's a very logical piece of work. I think the issue that we have is the concept of expertise. And Zachariah Sitchin's, you know, was a journalist, and he was obviously a scholar. He had a very scholarly sort of bent to him, and I guess I'm the same. I'm quite scholarly, but he, like I, am not experts in our field per se. We're not, you know, sitting professors within an astrophysics department, or in his case, within a Sumerology department. And when someone comes from left field and starts to produce really quite strong ideas about something, in his case, then it's going to be examined critically. And I guess in the last 5 or 10 years, unfortunately he died, you know, about a decade ago.
90 years old, 90, great guy.
He lived to a very healthy old age. I mean, fantastic guy. And he was writing right up to the end.
Oh, and he was sharp as a tack. I remember we gave him an award, Andy, at Conscious Life. We gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. And he was close to 90 when we gave him the award. And we called him up. I gave him the award, and he was ready to make his speech. And right before he did, I just said, Zachariah, exactly, tell us all, how old are you anyway? And he looked at me, and we were friends, but he looked at me and went, that's very rude. Just like that. Never got that answer. But then he passed away, and we realized he was 90 years old.
Yeah. I would love to have met him. I really wanted to come over and meet him in New York. And he and I had a little bit of correspondence going backwards and forwards. He used to use snail mail, as he used to call it. I don't think he ever really liked email. He may have done with you, George, but for me, it was write a letter and wait a few weeks.
Yeah, exactly. He was old school for sure.
He was. So, you know, he's had his detractors, and I mean, he's not in a position to be able to defend his work anymore, which I think is a bit of a thing, because people can throw all kinds of stuff at him, and clearly,
and they do
and clearly he made some semantic mistakes. You know, in some of the experts have come along and looked at some of the interpretations of the wordage of, you know, what's come out of Sumerian text from the cuneiform script, and also some of the other textual ancient texts that he came with. And you know, everyone makes mistakes. I'm sure he did. But actually, when I sit down and I look through, say, the Babylonian Enuma Elish, and I actually read a non-Sitchinite copy on the internet, and I just read through it, and I have in the back of my mind this interpretation from Sitchin, large chunks of it stand out. You know, I mean, a lot of the I think he's call it cosmogonic, but the cosmological stuff about stars and planets, it's there. You know, the tie-ins between those and the gods, and when you think about the fact that the gods of Rome and the gods of Greece were also associated with the planets as well. You know, Mars and Jupiter and so on. I mean, we still hold on to those words. We still have that connection within our own culture. So why wouldn't the Sumerians have the same? I mean, it makes total sense. These things get passed back.
And let me explain, Andy, to everybody what Sitchin's theories were, just so they can get a better impression of what we're going to be talking about tonight. He believed that there is this planet X in the solar system called Nibiru, which is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. That's why you can't see it all the time. It takes 3,600 years to go around the sun. And that it was inhabited by who he calls the Anunnaki, who came to this planet because they were looking for gold to pulverize and sprinkle in their atmosphere to protect it. And when they got here, they decided they didn't want to be the ones digging for the gold and doing all this stuff. So let's create something that's already on the planet and genetically alter them a little bit, and they'll work for us. And that's where we came in. They, whatever species might have been on the planet at the time, the Anunnaki apparently genetically altered them, Adam and Eve sort of, and here we are. And then, you know, we mined for gold. They took it. They left the planet, apparently, and off they went. Is that a pretty good capsule of what he did?
That's a pretty good capsule, George, yeah. And you know, he produced a tremendous amount of textual evidence to support that myth. I mean, yeah, that the Sumerian work that he drew upon that then became Babylonian work, as in the Enuma Elish and so on, I mean, the crux of what he was describing became a theme through the mythologies of that entire region, and it sort of evolved as it went along. So it then also sort of started to come into biblical work. So the first book or so of the Old Testament started to have allusions that would come from Sumerian texts. And that made sense because those early biblical texts were being sort of brought together, and the Talmud was being brought together while the Jews were in exile in Babylon. And the Babylonians had been sort of, you know, their interpretation had been drawn upon the Sumerians. So it all kind of ticked along. So you could pull things out about, say, the flood. I mean, he talked quite a lot about the flood, and about he started to have a theory that was, you know, he picked up on a couple of theories at the time about the flood that he was relating then to this same planet that, as you say, Nibiru, that came round every 3,600 years. So what he tried to do was take those interpretations about the gods that visited Earth and look at the planet and say, okay, well, then I can make predictions about this planet. And he was trying to understand what had happened over a long period of time as a result of this planet's existence, which did shake our understanding of the solar system up. And that's kind of where my interest lies, is trying to understand whether his interpretation about the planets within our solar system is making more sense of our solar system than our current model. And I personally believe that it does, but with the proviso that I think he got one thing wrong.
And that was?
I think that there's two ways of looking at this, but the 3,600-year thing may be out because it seems...
Shorter or longer?
It's a lot longer, I suspect.
Maybe.
A lot longer.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. Exactly, maybe. Now, there's one possibility where that might be correct, and that is that Nibiru, the meaning of the word is, well, it's a planet of the crossing is something that Sitchin used to talk about, but the crossing in the sense of a ferry, in the sense of something moving from one shore to another shore. And in that sense, Nibiru, if it is a planetary object, a minor planetary object, it might have a connection between us and another location, and therefore the 3,600 thing might be somewhat correct because it might be, in a sense, taking us towards another locale within the outer solar system. So it's possible the 3,600 years is correct, but if we're actually going to talk about a very substantial planet in the outer solar system, and we're going to get onto Planet 9 and so on, if we're going to start talking about that, then that kind of planet necessarily becomes something that has an orbit in the tens mm-hmm. of thousands of years.
Do you, Andy, do you believe this planet is inhabited?
Yes. Well, so my initial foray into this subject, which is back in the 1990s now, I was very interested in this Nibiru, and I wanted to understand how it was that a planet in, beyond Pluto, which would be, you know, extremely cold, could support life. So that was my first major issue with this. And, you know, it was a criticism of Sitchin's work that was sort of on the table already, but I was trying to figure it out. And I was also reading at the time and interested in the concept of a body called Nemesis, which is sort of an alternative outer solar system planet, but of much bigger size. So the idea of Nemesis, which was a concept that came out in the 1980s, was that it was a very small substellar object, like a brown dwarf potentially, that would be flung out into the very outer reach of the solar system. So its orbit around the sun would be about 27-30 million years long. And the idea of this planet was that periodically its orbit would sort of fluctuate, and it would move through a comet cloud. And when it moved through the comet cloud, it would fling comets down into the inner solar system. And every 27 or 30 million years ago, we would get bombarded by these comets. Now, the reason why this thought theory emerged in the 1980s was that the extinctions that had happened on Earth over the last, say, 500 million years appear to be cyclical. And again, this is a contentious theory, but they appear to have a rolling program of extinctions every 28, 30 million years or so, depending on how you look at it. And that needs an explanation. And that whole extinction thing, that's still being debated today. So 40 years on, there's still a bit of argument about that. So Nemesis was this idea that was dreamed up by astrophysicists to explain the extinction cycle. A guy called Matisse, and I'm trying to remember what the other guy is. It will come to me in a minute. So I thought to myself, well, look, here we go. If we've got a brown dwarf in the solar system, then it's effectively potentially got its own planetary system attached to it. Because why wouldn't it? I mean, you know, if all the stars in the galaxy potentially got their own planets, then why couldn't a brown dwarf in our solar system out in the peripheries also have their own planets? And if that's the case, then you've got warmth, you've got potentially a bit of light, but you've certainly got the heat and the gravitational attraction of this thing to make life on a moon habitable. So I started to think, okay, a lot of scientists argue that we couldn't have been visited by aliens on this planet, because how would they have got here from other stars traveling, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 light years? If we've got a Nemesis object in our outer solar system, then potentially we could have some light in our backyard, so to say, which is, you know, a realistic proposition for travel across these sort of great expanses of space. So then I started to think, well, okay, let's bring these two ideas together. We've got potentially a Nemesis idea that's, you know, it's talking about catastrophism, but really, actually, it creates the basis of another solar system, effectively, in our backyard. And Sitchin's idea, which is, you know, the gods are in the backyard, they're coming and visiting us, they need a habitable world. And I drew the two together, and I tried to coalesce them with some success, I guess. So I started to say, well, look, let's just argue then that Nibiru is in some way connected, or is actually a sort of brown dwarf object. And then you solve multiple problems all at the same time.
Hold on, Andy. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about the possibility of Nibiru in our solar system. And next hour, we'll take phone calls. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Andy Lloyd with us. His latest book, Darker Stars, which came out a few weeks ago, Andy, didn't it?
Yeah, it was only available from about 4 months ago or something like that. But yeah, a few weeks really in the great scheme of things, George. And I'm really excited about it. It took me 2 years to write the book, and my publisher's done an amazing job of putting it together. It's full of some beautiful, beautiful images, and the paperback's got a fantastic index. So for researchers, it's really good in paperback, and for anyone who really wants to sort of get into the imagery of this. And, you know, it is difficult to explain this just verbally. Sometimes you need the images just to really be able to understand some of these concepts. But I'll try my best over the phone.
Well, you're doing a good job, let me tell you. So Nibiru, if it's not like an exact planet, but more of a dwarf, you think?
Yes, well, you know, we've got a range of possibilities. I think the best way of putting this is the further out it is, the larger it could be. So if you wanted to go, I mean, the extent of the solar system is absolutely vast. You know, we tend to think of the solar system as being, you know, the eight planets, or Pluto as well, if you want the ninth there, running up to that point, and then that's sort of it. But that's actually just a tiny fraction of the solar system. Beyond Neptune, there is just this massive expanse of space where the sun still is in control of the objects, and they're all orbiting around it, comets mostly. So that area is undiscovered ground. It's quite exciting, really, to contemplate the possibilities. You know, clearly there could be lots of minor planets, and we now know that there's a second asteroid belt beyond Neptune called the Kuiper Belt. Which one of that New Horizons probe just went to and saw that object called Ultima Thule. That was that thing that looked a little bit like an icy snowman. And, you know, we're starting to understand a little bit more about that. So if you were to understand, have a possibility of a brown dwarf, I mean, the word brown dwarf itself is actually a type of a star. It's a very small type of star. And I would caution here that use of the word brown dwarf gives the impression that it is actually a lit object that is giving out light. Now if that's the case, it just, there's no way it could be there, because it would be just so easy to spot. It would be ridiculously easy to spot. But the thing about brown dwarfs, and certainly the sub-brown dwarfs, which is, you know, a smaller version and a bit more like Jupiter, is that they kind of use up their fuel really early. So we can see them in other solar systems when they're very, very young. They're still burning up fuel. And then they kind of go dark and dim. And then they become very, very difficult to spot. So if we're thinking about something, we use the word brown dwarf for ease, really. But really, we're talking about something that's kind of old. And clearly, if Sitchin was right, this thing is old, because it came through the solar system fairly early on in the solar system. So it's at least, you know, 4 billion years old.
Well, like the rest of us, I guess, right?
Yeah. You know? So, you know, it's going to be difficult to spot at a great distance. What it can't be, what you can't have, and I'm really sorry to disappoint people who think this is a possibility, and I recognize I'm culpable here, because I kind of generated this whole idea in the first place, but what you can't have is a brown dwarf star, you know, incoming, like, in our face right now, because this thing would just be so colossal, the size of, you know, Jupiter and smoldering thing. I mean, it's an exciting idea, but it's got to be way out there.
Do you think, though, Andy, do you think astronomers, if they really found it, would tell us? For some reason, they're holding back. I don't know why, but I just have that feeling.
Do you know what? I sort of had a little conversation recently with a astronomer about alien life, and I made the point that you know, they have this Drake equation thing.
Yes,
they try and work out
probabilities of
exactly probabilities, and it everything's about probabilities, George. Everything's about probabilities. So I sort of threw in the remark that, well, do you know what's the probability that the conspiracy theorists are right? You know, it's not zero. You know, you can't look at this and say there's no chance whatsoever that they're wrong. You know, there is a chance that people who are studying our historical evidence for alien visitation and so on are right. It's non-zero. Now, it might be 0.5%, it might be 1%, it might be 0.1%. I really no idea. But it's quantifiable in the sense that you could determine, yeah, you know, there is a chance that they're right. Now, if that's true, then when you're looking at something like the Frank Drake equation, when you're looking at that and you're trying to determine whether life could exist out there, you also have to bear in mind this extra factor, which is, hey, what if the government of the world, or the governments of the world, or the science community in themselves unconsciously are in some way preventing us from realizing the truth? Now, governments, I suspect, would be in a position to be able to do that in a very covert way. if it was the people in the scientific community, it would be more to do with attitude. It would be that they actually, their knee-jerk reaction to this is nonsense. We're going to say no. It has to be, as Sagan once said, extraordinary evidence for an extraordinary claim. And, you know, Stanton Friedman, who unfortunately
God rest his soul.
Departed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bless him. He was a fantastic, fantastic guy. I saw him speak once, and it just absolutely blew me.
I was with him the day before he died.
No, really?
I will tell you, when we're done chatting for just a bit here, I'll tell you a story that'll blow your mind.
So Stanton Friedman always said, well, what is extraordinary evidence? You either have evidence or you don't have evidence, right? So there isn't extraordinary evidence. So he always argued, look, there is evidence on the table for alien life. So if Stanton Friedman, let's say Stanton Friedman was correct, and, you know, I think he was a really, really intelligent guy who was really tuned in. Let's say he's correct. Then that makes the Frank Drake equation need this factor. What if we use the word conspiracy theorist, but actually I just think it's people with a different, you know, a different view on this and who've got different arguments. It doesn't, you know, you don't need to be derogatory about it. People who are into conspiracies are actually just questioning our reality and saying, you know, there may be something more that's going on here. So if they're correct, then there's that possibility that life is out there, but we're just missing it because either we're not being told the truth or we've actually got blinkers on. Now, I think it's more likely that we've just got blinkers
on. I think so. And is it conceivable that the planet Zechariah Sitchin is talking about is different from the one you're talking about, and that there's more than one, extra one?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Because this outer solar system is just absolutely vast, you know, we could have 10 planet X's out there. We just don't know. And, you know, the problem that Planet X has always had is that people who talk about how planets form, who try to work out how they accrete, can't understand how a planet could get out there because they would need to form nearer the sun. And that is the main stumbling block for saying, well, we could have, like, you know, any number of planets out there, really. But the thing is that now that we've been discovering all these exoplanets in other solar systems, it's made us realize that there's a great variety in the universe, in the galaxy, of planets, and it's made us sort of question our own understanding of how planets form. Sure, the vast majority of them form in protoplanetary disks. They do exactly what the mainstream astrophysicists say. I'm absolutely certain. But there is also, I think, ways of producing planets beyond these very strict confines. And it's kind of an observational bias. We can see those environments. We can see young stars with their protoplanetary disk, and therefore we assume that's where it's all going on. But actually there are areas which we can't see because they're not lit up by stars. And, you know, part of the reason I've written Darker Stars is because I want to start to talk about, are there other ways of forming planets beyond these areas, or how realistic is it to be able to put planets out into the outer solar system? And I think actually there's a, you know, some really, really strong possibilities, and I've produced some theories in this book to explain why.
Now, the thought of this planet X in our solar system was that it would wreak havoc whenever it got close to planet Earth, the great flood, just about anything. Do you think that's still the case?
I think there's a possibility. Again, if Nibiru is a ferry, if it is an object that's coming into the solar system from the direction of, you know, an alternative solar system or a brown dwarf system or whatever it might be, or even a Planet 9 system, a super Earth, then, you know, there is the potential for disruption, because these objects, they can come with an array of materials. You can have comet swarms, and you're back into that whole thing with the nemesis thing, which is the idea of, you know, periodic impacts and so on. So, yeah, there is a possibility of that. But what I would say is you've got to be realistic about trying to place that into our current time zone, because we live now and we tend to want to think we're living in some sort of unique or important time. We tend to think, well, is it happening now? And you know, I think the Planet X subject itself has been very much taken over with this idea that this object is right upon us and it's going to cause an impending catastrophe. And, you know, whether you've got whether you think that there may be something to that or you're strongly against, that is in a way taking over the entire debate. And I'm trying to, you know, I would personally prefer to get beyond that and just say, look, let's just assume this thing's a long way out. Let's just talk about what happens when it's discovered and what the implications are in terms of, you know, alien life and our own history and all this stuff that Sitchin wrote about. Because for me, that's the story. That's what this is all about. And that's the scary paradigm shifting material that, you know, needs to be grappled with. But somehow or other, it's taken a backseat to the sort of, you know, incoming thing.
Well, are they concerned that there may be a planet that's inhabited and hence they don't want to tell us? Or is it just another planet, big deal? You know, if there's another planet in the solar system beyond Pluto, tell us about it. Who cares? You know, who's going to get upset? But if there's life on that planet, that could be why they're holding back, Andy.
I agree entirely. So at the moment, in the last few years, we've had a rash of papers that have come out about an object which is very similar to what Sitchin wrote about, and that is Planet Nine. Now, the guys who've come up with Planet Nine have written the papers, done some extremely elegant work mathematically to produce a really good case for the existence of Planet Nine. They essentially rebranded Planet X as Planet Nine. There's a reason they did that, George. They didn't just sort of think, oh, well, let's just call it Planet Nine. Well, there were two reasons. One of them was one of the guys, Mike Brown, he felt somewhat responsible for the sort of loss of status of Pluto. So he kind of renamed the planet Nine. But there's also this desire to take a step back from the kind of work like people like me and Sitchin have done and a lot of the other researchers on the internet have done and say, look, you know, this is just a planet. We're just looking for a planet here. You know, let's just forget all this other stuff. If we can find a new planet, that's a fantastic scientific discovery. All power to them, I get it. From their perspective, the things do not mix. They're interested in the science, they're interested in finding a planet, they're not interested in the kind of stuff I'm talking about, and they probably think it's a load of rubbish. Totally get that, that's fine. Now, so they've produced this amazing evidence about these objects in the solar system and the way they cluster together, and it creates very strong indirect evidence for the existence of this planet. And that is, you know, what's really weird about it from my perspective is that their description of it, firstly, when I wrote Dark Star back in 2005, I put in a description of what this thing would look like. It didn't look like Sitchin's Nibiru. It was a, you know, sort of a new idea. What they describe, I've got a picture of it on page 168. What they've described is exactly what I did in the book 10 years ago. So I thought, well, hold on, I've just predicted Planet Nine from 10 years before these guys came out with it. So I was very excited about that. And the more I read their paper and the more I looked at it, I realized that there were other aspects of this that actually connected with Sitchin's work as well. The way this thing was aligned in the heavens, the axis that it was on and where it would pin up. And I thought, hold on, guys, you're actually saying the same stuff as him. It's an inclined orbit. It's pointing on an axis from its perihelion position that, you know, coincides with the kind of constellations that Sitchin was also talking about. And actually, they talk about it being the same size as well. You know, they're talking about a super Earth, and he talked about Nibiru being something that was like five Earth masses or so. And certainly Planet Nine starting to look a lot like Nibiru. But like I said to you before, when we were discussing before the break, George, that the issue then was that they're saying, well, this thing's about, I don't know, 800, 500 astronomical units. They're calling it 500 now. That actually means that it's got, you know, it's necessarily got an orbit of tens of thousands of years, and that's where the break is. So it's not, you know, that 3,600 number doesn't really fit with it, but lots of other things do. So, you know, I look at that and I say, okay, the science guys, they've come up with something that looks a lot like many of the things Sitchin wrote about. It coincides with what I put in the book 10 years before, which is kind of a prediction. I think, you know, that kind of makes it, that provides some merit to look at Sitchin's thing and say, well, maybe he was right. Maybe he was right. Maybe there is a non-zero possibility that Sitchin was right, but they don't want to think about it. I understand why they don't want to think about it, but they don't want to think about it. So let's say then they find this thing. Let's say they find this thing. and they start to admit it. Exactly.
So.
Admit it. They are going to hold on to, for grim life, the possibility that, hey, we found a planet, but there's no life on there. No life. Because, you know, they don't want to cross that Rubicon. And I understand why, but they don't want to cross that Rubicon. But I would be saying, okay, you know, if you took Sitchin's work, and to a lesser extent my own, but Sitchin's mainly, if you took Sitchin's work and you used that as a predictive tool for the planet that you've now found, if there's a fit, and he predicted it, like he did with some of the properties of Uranus and Neptune from reading of the old texts, if there's a fit, then you should be giving this some credibility. You should be looking at it and saying, why is there a fit? How on earth did this man know this? His knowledge was from ancient text. What is that telling us about what the Sumerians knew? So we can't do that yet because we haven't found the planet.
They even knew that Earth got involved in a collision with another object. Who would know that?
Well, we know that the Earth did get involved.
And the Sumerians knew that. How would they know that?
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that I've been, one of the other aspects of the research that I do is trying to find the evidence from what's happened to the Earth to explain, to sort of verify Sitchin's theory, if possible. I mean, I'm not saying it's absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about that, Andy, when we come back, and then we'll take our final hour phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.